Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
Today, I'm joined by Neda Burgess, a trainee in the West Midlands, and we're going to be speaking about her personal experience of developing post-traumatic stress disorder following being redeployed during COVID-19. Neda, thank you so much for agreeing to share your really personal experiences today with me. Before we actually talk about how this has really affected you on a personal and emotional level, I was wondering if you could maybe just share with myself and the listeners what exactly happened in terms of COVID, redeployment, and the events surrounding that time.
Thank you very much for having me here, and I think it's so important that we are opening up this conversation as well, so thank you for that too. With regards to your question, I got redeployed during the peak of the pandemic to one of the hospitals in the West Midlands. It was actually just after I had recovered from COVID myself. And I got redeployed with a few of the other ophthalmology trainees who were working in the same trust as me. And the way we got deployed was almost like a message through the grapevine, really. It was one of the ophthalmology consultants who had a discussion with one of the medical consultants and then sent a message through one of the secretaries who then got in touch with us to ring one of the medical consultants. So that's the way our deployment happened. And we phoned up this medical consultant saying that we were happy to help out. And a couple of days later, we were due to start our first shift on the COVID wards. Our first day of turning up, we were just turned up to the medical induction with a whole group of the medical doctors that were due to cover all the medical wards that day. We were sort of just thrown in at the deep end. I did flag up that I was an ophthalmology registrar and that I would need some support from a medical doctor as well. And I was sent to one of the COVID positive wards. This was a ward where every single patient had COVID, but they also had complex medical needs on top of that. Just to paint the picture for you a little bit, it was the peak of the pandemic. Everybody was terrified of getting COVID. So people would only come into hospital when they were really, really sick. So they were either sick with COVID-related issues and came into hospital, or they were sick with other medical issues, but they would try to stay out of hospital as long as possible and only come in when they were very, very ill. So the presentations of these medical cases were even more unwell patients than you would normally have on medical wards. And to top it all off, they all were COVID positive as well. And I was looking after 17 patients to do a ward round on my first day. And I did flag up that I would need some support. And I was given the support of an obs and gynae consultant. So there were the two of us trying to muddle through on our first day of doing a medical ward round. We did have a med reg on the other half of the ward covering the other 17 patients. So it was a ward of 34 patients altogether. It was a very slow process, as you can imagine, especially on the first time, going back to general medicine. And as ophthalmology trainees, we thought that our general medical days were long behind us. Many of us very happy about that. And then here we were thrown into the deep end again. But we did have, the medical reg on the other half of the ward was very happy to help out and to answer any questions. They were very aware that we were completely thrown in the deep end there.
So going back to what you said about the way in which you were told you were going to be redeployed, perhaps in hindsight it sounds like that might have been a conversation which would have better been had by one of your senior colleagues to you, to check that you were happy and that you were able to maybe go there. When you were told by the secretary that you were going to be redeployed to the medical wards, how did you feel? What was going through your mind at that point?
Oh, it was such a mix of emotions. It's very difficult to describe. Even reflecting on our whole experience of being deployed, I think it's something that we'll reflect on for years to come. None of us ever expected to be in the situation where a pandemic was going to reach the UK. Like so many outbreaks have happened, in the world in the past, over these past few years, and none of them have reached the UK, and definitely not to this extent. So we were in a very unknown situation. There were so many stresses and worries. There was the anxieties about the risk to our own health. There was the anxieties of the risk to the health of our loved ones that we lived with. You know, if we go to these medical wards, what are we going to bring home? And then also being so far out of our comfort zone, are we going to be a risk to patients as well? If we haven't worked in general medicine for so long, are we going to forget something or miss something? You know, and the first thing that we learn as medics is, number one, first do no harm. You know, and are we going to do some harm, you know, inadvertently? So there was lots and lots of worries. But at the same time, I was quite keen to volunteer and to help out because it was such an unusual circumstance and there was this sense of duty. So when I was speaking to the medical consultant, they did say, you know, are you happy to help out? And I did say, yes, I'm willing. You know, where do you want me? So, but I did make it very clear what my expertise was, which was limited in that I would need some medical support there. But it did seem quite different in practice.
I think that's probably similar across the board in, you know, most people. But it's a question of, you know, what we can do to help out. Because, you know, both of us, you know, we're not exactly fresh off the boat junior trainees.
Yes, exactly.
Who have recently been working on the medical wards. You know, we've been in ophthalmology for some time now. I think it would be fair to say that our medical skills are slightly rusty. So, you know, you actually mentioned before that you'd had COVID before. Do you know how you actually caught COVID? And, you know, what was your actual experience physically of having COVID?
It's difficult to know exactly the exact pinpoint of when I caught COVID. But at the time, so 2 weeks, you know, in the weeks leading up to when I was sick, I was reviewing emergency patients, you know, ophthalmology with ophthalmology issues on COVID suspect wards. Now, there was a lot of deliberation about the PPE guidelines at the time, and as you probably remember, the guidelines were changing on, you know, a weekly basis. So at that time, I was going up to review patients with eye-related emergencies on the wards, and these were COVID suspect wards. And at the time, the PPE was to, you know, to use a surgical mask. Whether it was enough is a whole different ball game. But I ended up getting sick with COVID, so I assume I must have picked it up from that exposure. I was actually quite sick with COVID myself. I did have quite significant symptoms. I didn't need oxygen. I didn't need to go into hospital. But for me, I'm otherwise fit and well, and relatively young as well. But I was quite unwell. I had relentless fevers for about 9 days, you know, persistent cough as they talk about, but the shortness of breath was the most significant thing. I was comfortable at rest, but any sort of movement, I was quite significantly short of breath. I was unable to prepare myself any food. I wasn't even able to stand up to make myself a cup of tea. If I was going to walk upstairs to the bathroom, I would have to stop on the stairs to catch my breath. At night time, I wasn't able to lie flat. If I lay flat, I'm pretty sure I must have had pleural effusions. I did actually listen to my own chest, and I had like reduced air entry at my bases. And if I laid flat, I was really gasping for breath for a good, you know, 20 minutes afterwards, and I'd have to sit upright. So trying to fall asleep was quite difficult because I'd have to at least have four pillows at night to sleep. And it was quite worrying because, you know, you think then to your parents, who obviously much older than me, have other medical issues, and you think, gosh, if I'm otherwise fit and well and relatively young and these are the symptoms I've had, how would my loved ones manage with such serious issues? So it did really bring it home.
It sounds as though, you know, you had symptoms on more of the severe end of the spectrum there, and it sounds quite terrifying, actually.
It was.
So, you know, once you were redeployed on the wards, what was your experience? You know, what kind of jobs were you expected to do? You know, what kind of responsibilities did you actually have there?
So there was the carrying out the ward rounds on a daily basis. So I had varying support for that. So every other day there was a consultant ward round. So we would go round with the consultant. On the other days, you would be doing it independently, or if, you know, I'd really try and flag up to make sure that I had some support from another medic as well. There were medical students as well, which was great. They were all very keen, but I would obviously select which jobs they would do, you know, bloods and cannulas, you know, generally the odd jobs like that. But the most challenging part of it was the end-of-life care. I'd never experienced so much end-of-life in such a short space of time in all my career. Every day you would come in, you wouldn't know which patients had survived, and it was the breaking the bad news over the phone to the relatives, which was just simply heartbreaking. And it was several times a day having to do that, whether it was discussing with relatives about deterioration to end-of-life care or breaking bad news that they had died. I think every single phone call, I was silently crying on the other side of the phone too. That was the hardest part. And the relatives not being able to come in to be with their loved ones. So there was all these patients coming into hospital to do what I feared the most, really, which was to die alone. And it's so difficult when you have a mask on. You can't offer, sometimes what you want to offer your patients is a smile, you know, a comforting smile. And you can't do that. You know, you're almost expressionless because there's so, you know, when your face covers, you know, your face is covered with so much of the mask. So it was very difficult. And you're afraid sometimes to get too close to the patients as well, because of the risk to your own health at the same time. So, you know, my colleagues and the nursing staff as well, well, it's worrying sitting by a patient, and you know, a lot of them were delirious with infection and coughing, you know, all over you, you know, which is, you know, I'm sure aerosol generating in itself. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah, that's so incredibly difficult, isn't it? You know, when you just feel that you're inhibited from, you know, delivering the kind of compassionate care that you're used to and that you want to, just from all the protocols, all the safety concerns, and you know what you said about, you know, patients not being able to be with their loved ones as they're dying. You know, that's you know, something that when we think of, you know, how we might imagine ourselves, you know, passing away, you know, it's the one thing that you couldn't imagine, really. I think it's a uniquely upsetting time. So, you know, you've been through all these really terrible experiences, really. And, you know, when did you start to feel that, you know, this was really starting to have a toll on your well-being?
I think that when I was first deployed and having this experience, I was almost in automatic mode. And I realised a few weeks later that it was taking its toll on me. So I was feeling very, very down and just had such low energy. It was mainly my mood that I realised, and it, you know, anxieties were coming up. I was getting quite anxious about things. You know, I was very irritable. So I'm not normally a very irritable person, but I would be sort of snapping at things, and I just didn't feel myself. Yeah, mainly my mood was the issue.
You know, when you're working such long hours, you're dealing with such emotionally charged situations, and you're going through such an upsetting period, possibly it's normal to feel, you know, slightly moody or anxious or not yourself, just through pure stress.
Yes.
But, you know, at what point did you think, you know what, this is more than what I would consider normal than the response to what the situation was?
I would usually consider myself as someone who's quite good at, you know, looking after myself emotionally. Like, I do meditation and mindfulness on a pretty regular basis anyway. And usually that sort of helps me. I usually get picked up. So if I'm a bit low or I'm a bit stressed out or something, I do some of that. And over the course of days or a week or something, I would be picked up. But it didn't. I was just, it was continuously, it was just a continuous feeling of me being down. And unfortunately, I did start to have some really dark thoughts. And I think that's when I really flagged up to myself that I needed some support more than, you know, just trying to manage this myself.
When you started to feel like that, you know, what did you do? You know, who did you talk to?
So I actually, first of all, spoke to like family, really close family, my friends, my partner, who were all really fantastic. They advised that I have a chat with my GP, which I did. And then I got in touch with a therapist as well, and just had a few sessions with a therapist to discuss my experience and what I had been through and my emotions and everything. And that's when the therapist said to me, you know, you're actually suffering with PTSD. So that's what I went through. I did actually speak to my supervisor as well, one of the ophthalmology consultants, who was absolutely fantastic. Too, so very supportive, and gave me similar advice to speak to my GP and a therapist too.
Mm. How did the medical team respond when you said that you were going through this problem?
After speaking to the ophthalmology consultant, my supervisor, he advised that I send an email to the medical consultant and CC him in to say that this is how I was feeling, to try and get some time off. Unfortunately, I wasn't met with that much support, and the deployment wasn't sort of cut short for me or anything. So I was just informed that I would have another 2 weeks of work on the medical wards, but there was no provisions for me to take leave. And so when my redeployment ended, from the ophthalmology end, they gave me some leave. I think in hindsight, I probably should have taken some sick leave back then, but I didn't recognize it being that bad at that point, and I thought I could just muddle on. And I think this is part of the issue of being a doctor, is that we do just muddle on. We sort of try and push ourselves and get on with it, rather than, you know, to make a big song and dance about our emotions and how we're feeling.
So you actually continued to work on the medical wards, you know, for a further 2 weeks after flagging up your concerns to your supervisor, to your GP, and the medical consultant, you know, about your mental health.
Yes, that's right, yes.
I think, as you said, one of the major problems with the medical profession is that we don't treat ourselves like the way we treat our patients. I think we're all guilty of feeling under the weather, feeling, you know, fairly unwell in ourselves, you know, not feeling great, and coming to work, either when we were foundation doctors or, you know, even in ophthalmology, because we know that if we don't come in, there's very little buffer for the hospital service to fill in what we would have otherwise been doing. Patients will have been waiting for us. The clinics are booked, the patients are going to come. And for good or for bad, I think we're all guilty of having that sense of obligation, and perhaps putting patients above our own care. And, you know, I think maybe we probably as a profession need to realise that we're not invincible, and that we can have health conditions and health problems too.
I think it is that little bit harder. I completely agree with what you said, and it is that little bit harder when it comes down to mental health. It's that much harder to speak about, and unfortunately there is still so much taboo in the medical profession, particularly with doctors, I feel, and particularly in surgery as well, about having mental health issues. I do feel like this is changing, but it's not fast enough. And it's a shame that something so, you know, horrific as this pandemic had to come along before we really paid attention to this ongoing mental health of doctors, because it isn't something that only applies now. This applied from the beginning of our training. And, you know, if we look back, you know, majority of us were only 23 or 24 years old when we first qualified as doctors. And we were dealing with things like death or domestic violence cases or child abuse cases and cancer. And we've been expected to just sort of get on with it. We have this like aspect of our portfolios that scores our resilience. And this is a part of our portfolios that our consultant will score what their perception of our resilience is. But our consultants don't really know what we're dealing with internally. And we do have to make it seem like we are okay and everything's okay, because we don't want people to think that we can't cope with life as a doctor, and we don't want that to go against us. So I think that there is that aspect too, but I do agree that we don't want to be on the other end, as we call it, of the doctor-patient dynamic. It's almost almost like we see our patients as muggles and we're the magic folk, and we don't want to be the muggles.
I think one of the main issues is, as you said, there's a really big stigma for people to come up and say, you know what, I'm struggling, because people fear of being judged. I think, you know, that's literally the way people feel. I've got, you know, loads of friends who work in medicine, and I hear from them that they just feel completely overwhelmed, you know, from the intensity of the work they've been having to do over the last few weeks and months, from the harrowing situations that they've had to be in. And, you know, not one of them, I don't think, has felt comfortable just even, you know, saying that, you know what, I'm feeling completely overwhelmed. Because I think that's become the normal situation. People are almost ashamed of admitting when they're struggling with something. And I hope maybe that by the fact that, you know, you've talked about this, maybe that people might have a bit more confidence to start to, you know, talk about their feelings. What do you think that you could have done differently?
I could have definitely got support much earlier. Could have spoken about how I was feeling much earlier, checking in with myself much earlier, not to just, you know, try and push those emotions down and try and just get on with it. And to really insist that I do take some leave. You know, you almost don't want to make a fuss, but actually when it does come down to mental health, managing things sooner rather than later is always better, as otherwise it can take much more of a toll on you and it can take that much longer to heal. So I think it would have been better if I spoke to my family and friends about it much sooner, got in touch with the GP sooner, taken some sick leave sooner. I think that would have been better. I think little things as well, like even keeping a journal of what you've been through, and it's almost like your own self-therapy to write about what you've gone through. I think that's a really simple but effective way of trying to manage your emotions, you know, and mindfulness and meditation. Obviously, that's quite a big thing nowadays, but actually engaging with it and having some sort of daily practice of something for yourself. Like, I think mental health is so multifactorial and there are so many protective factors, whether it's like hobbies or family or friends. And sometimes we do forget to invest time in this and, you know, and effort and money as well. But actually, we've got to make this a part of our daily life, and especially with the job that we do, and especially now.
I personally also do mindfulness, and I can actually fully recommend that too. So, Neda, you know, from an institutional perspective, with regards to, you know, medical training in general, the way that hospitals support doctors, what do you think needs to change to maybe possibly prevent people from having to go through the same thing that you went through, or even to maybe give, you know, more support to people who might be going through the same thing?
I think that things are coming up a little bit more now. There's much more awareness now in the wake of this pandemic about mental health amongst doctors. And I think this is really good. So I hope that things are changing. But this is almost something that needed to be in place before. So I know that there are some well-being hubs that have come up in and around Birmingham, you know, offering some confidential chats that you can have with a counsellor, or you can go in for meditations, or you can go in for free massages as well. So this is all really fantastic. I think it's really the culture of medicine that needs to change. That's a really difficult thing to just say as such a big topic. But I saw such a difference in the way that consultants responded to me, you know, standing up and saying, look, my mental health is suffering here. I had my ophthalmology consultant who was so supportive and so understanding, and then one of the medical consultants that was really the opposite. And so it does, when you're faced with, you know, a difficult response, when you're faced with like a barrier, it makes it so much harder to support yourself. Especially with mental health, you feel very fragile and you feel very vulnerable, and a lot of the time you don't want to draw attention to yourself, but we need to make sure that we get that support. So in that short term, it's that much harder. And if you're faced with a consultant or a senior or a peer that is not understanding or not supportive, it's very, very difficult. But I do think this is all part of the culture of medicine.
Yeah, definitely. We all talk about, you know, the possible benefits of the pandemic in the future, you know, perhaps relating to the way in which we change practice with regards to, you know, more virtual clinics and more efficient patient management strategies. But, you know, perhaps more importantly, coming from the pandemic, is that if we can change the way we look at people's well-being, you know, after this, you know, that might be one of the biggest positives.
I mean, mental health issues amongst doctors have been there for a long time. We know that, in general, junior doctors have a higher risk of suicide in comparison to the rest of the population. And, you know, just talking about the local junior doctors in Birmingham, and we had two junior doctor suicides last year in one hospital in the space of about a month apart. You know, and since this COVID pandemic has come about, there have been, you know, really sad cases around the world of, you know, doctors taking their own lives as well because of the stresses of what they faced. So yes, it's a problem that's been there for a long time, and it's, like you said, it's hopefully one of the good things that's going to come out of this pandemic, that we will start paying more attention to this.
So Neda, the most important question I need to ask you really is, how are you now feeling in yourself?
So I recognise that this is still early days and it's going to take me some time to heal, which is why actually even speaking out about this with you now has been quite difficult. But I know that it's an ongoing issue. So I'm still getting support. I'm still getting sessions with a therapist. I'm doing my best to do what I can to help my mental health. But I'm still very much recovering, and I recognise that. But I'm hopeful that what I'm going through is just temporary, and things will get better.
Well, Neda, thank you so much for joining me today, for being so brave, for being courageous and, sharing such a personal experience. I really hope that will, potentially help other people to, come forward and seek the support they need as well.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. And yes, I completely agree. I really hope that there are people out there who can relate to what I've been talking about and do get some support, which is what this is all about.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.